Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Hi, Jonathan Goldhill here, and welcome back to another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. And today's show is going to be with an industry veteran in the landscape industry. Some might know it as the green industry. Barry Elder is 31 years in the green industry. He's a veteran working in landscape construction, distribution, manufacturing. He's a longtime California Landscape Contractors Association member, where he's been master of ceremonies at the state and local events level. He's been a board member there. And I've known Barry because Barry is like the ultimate traveling salesman. He has been on the road throughout the pandemic selling his wares, and he currently works for Weathermatic, which is an amazing company in the irrigation control space. So did I get that right, Barry?
Yeah, you did, actually. That was very good.
Fantastic. So welcome to the show today. So you've been in this business for a really long time. And yeah, you feel old. And you've worked for a lot of family businesses. So take us a little bit through your biography and tell us a little bit about some of the companies you've worked for and what the experience has been like.
Technically, three major companies. I mean, that I've been, I cut my teeth at 20 years old in the industry in landscape, high-end landscape construction, worked for a gentleman, had a successful high-end residential landscape construction business, and worked there from the bottom up from 20 to 20 years old for almost 8 years, and did, beautiful homes. That's where I was sprung on it, and I was locked and loaded from the first house that we did, from a dirt lot to a finished product with waterfalls and fire pits. And I was just like, oh, this is it. And the rest is history. And then I went to, from there, I went to FX Luminaire on the manufacturer side, because of all the experience and all the low voltage lighting installation that we did as a company. We became recognized throughout the state. And I caught the eye of the owner of FX Luminaire, and was offered a job and went there and was national sales manager there for 6+ years. And then from there, because of travel and a new baby coming, I had to make a move of getting off the road a little bit. I was offered a job from Doug York for Ewing Irrigation. And I was 16 years there until just recently here, and have jumped ship back to the manufacturer and wearing the manufacturing hat with Weathermatic. And all of them are family-owned businesses.
Super interesting.
I don't know anything but family-owned, so there you go.
Well, I think that's really interesting. And let's just pause for a moment. You're the only guy I know who has been traveling and visiting customers throughout almost the entire pandemic. What's that experience been like?
It was a little different. I mean, I know for a fact that I've done, a lot of travel, but I've also done more Zoom meetings than I've ever had in my entire life in 6 months or so. But the traveling into distribution and into some contractors as well, it was some areas geographically are a lot more strict, if you will, on the COVID travel stuff, and some are a little more laid back. And so I had to respect all of that kind of during my travels. And thank God, knock on wood, I never got the COVID. I know a lot of people that have got it, actually, believe it or not, and they didn't travel. So I thought for sure it was a deal, but knock on wood, we're still out there, it was good. I didn't see very many other people that I knew other than the distributors, and that was about it.
Well, you must have felt like a lone wolf out there at times. I'm sure it was quieter in the hotels.
It was quieter and much more reasonable rates.
Yeah, I bet. Exactly. So let's talk about family businesses in the landscape industry. So I got into the landscape industry probably in 2005, right around then. And I had an epiphany when I moved into a house that had won two CLCA awards for, like, you know, they were award-winning residential landscapes. And I realized, wow, I really like landscaping. First of all, I love the beauty and the nature. And there are so many small mom and pop style businesses that I could be really helpful to. And you've worked for some of the larger, and I don't know their mom and pop, but they're family owned. Why do you think there's so many family owned businesses in the landscaping industry or construction in general? Have you ever paused to think about that?
One is that, you know, I mean, there's the licensed contractors and the non-licensed contractors, and it's an easier profession to start an upstart company. You know, if you really want to get into it, you can get a wheelbarrow and some small equipment and a truck and you can start. And some of these successful companies have started with that, a truck and one employee and a shovel, and went out and got their license or not. And did very, very well for themselves. Some are still doing well. Some are good with where they're at. They don't necessarily want to grow, but they're making and paying the bills and having a good living and working hard for it. So it's an easier, I would say, startup business than having to go into opening up a restaurant or any of these stuff and going through building codes and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You can kind of just go jump in the truck and make a name for yourself by doing something beautiful or maintaining something beautiful. And you can be very successful at it. And many, many companies have passed on through generations and have grown to be highly successful companies.
Yeah, so I was just going to share a story. So I remember Bert Sperber, who founded and grew Valley Crest, which got merged into Brickman, Colbert, Kravitz, Roberts, KKR, did that deal. Quite a successful company, literally started it like just working in the Valley doing landscaping, and grew that to $1 billion a year business. And, you know, it's quite amazing and interesting, full circle. My next door neighbor I'm having dinner with a couple weeks ago, and she just started working with Richard Sperber, Bert's son, as his chief of human resources. And interestingly enough, you know, he came off of his non-compete and is already built a company with 1,700 employees. So mergers and acquisitions is a big part of growing in this business. You've seen a lot of them, haven't you?
It is. And, you know, you observe the positives and negatives of the VCs of the world of purchasing companies. And there's good and bad on both sides of that, I think, for the industry. The one thing I will say that I believe that the overall scheme of it is that we see venture capitalists purchasing landscape companies. If you remember back, let's just go back 10 years or something, venture capitalists purchase software startups. They purchase smaller business. They're not purchasing landscape companies. So to me, that says the landscapers aren't going anywhere. We got VCs buying us now. So to me, that's kudos to the industry in general that we're here we're the real deal. I would say that when it comes to VCs or other large companies buying other companies. The other good thing is that there is some companies that are struggling that have worked their butts off for 35, 40 years, older couples or older gentlemen or wife or whatever it may be. And they're either going to just go under and lose a lot, or they have somebody that comes in that purchases the company and turns it around, gives them a nice golden check and golden handshake, and they're off to retirement. So that's the good side of it. Some of the bad side may be with some of the guys that are still in there having to battle against some of the VC money. They have more money, more resources. They can pull more employees at times because of benefits and medical and different things like that. So that would be a negative if you were to look at it that way when it comes to the industry and some of the other guys that aren't happy about that. But in general, I think overall, if we can keep the balance of family owned and entrepreneurial startups and VC larger companies, if that's a nice balance, I think it's a win-win.
Yeah, well, you know, you were citing the statistics of family-owned businesses before we started this call, and I asked you if you had read the back cover of my book because those statistics are cited there. But you know, landscaping is definitely an industry filled with a lot of family businesses, and as money moves in, venture capital, private equity money, it wants to start to acquire these companies. And as companies grow, you and I know you've worked with some, so have I, they start to get more corporate-like. And as they grow and they want to return value to the shareholders, the only way to achieve that kind of continued growth is through acquisition. So, the only two public companies that I know in the landscape space are True Green, I'm not sure they're still public, and Brightview. What's been your experience working around and working with those companies?
I worked directly with them. I was director of National Accounts for Ewing Irrigation, almost 10 years. So I worked directly with the Brickmans of the world at that time, and True Greens, and Davy Trees, and the national footprint companies. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily publicly traded, but at that time anyways, but had national footprints. And those were getting, the Brickmans all kind of came together during the Brightview kind of VC merger or purchase, if you will. And so I think in general, you can see, look at it both ways. I mean, there's the positives and negatives of that. And I think if the balance is good and everything is good, as in big money, big VC, raise the industry standards, continue to grow the name of the landscape industry, and the integrity and the quality, that's a good thing. If it's all about money and you get into losing the quality and getting in and out and just wham bam on jobs, then that's going to ruin the industry. I haven't seen really that so far in any of that. So I think it should be a good thing, but there is definitely a niche in the industry. There's clients that definitely do not want a larger corporate. They want the family owned. They want to deal with the son because they knew the father, and so on. So I don't think they're going away either. And I think a big part of it, I mean, we have examples in California of companies that have taken it next level. You have, you have Stay Green, you have the Angelo family, you have Rich and Rich and Powers Chris, you have K&D Landscape, you have Kendall and Justin, the president now. You have Jim, and you have Clayton Dinsmore, and we have Ryan with Alpine Landscape. I kind of go on and on. I mean, believe it or not, it's kind of cool that I read as well as $10 trillion of new business handing over family business to the millennials in the next 7 to 10 years. That's $10 trillion. So there is a lot of family business that's going to continue with the millennials. And the truth of the matter is they've raised the bar, and it's no disrespect to the Rich Angelos or the Kendall Whites of the world and anything like that. It's just the truth of the matter is they now have technology and software and all the tools. They set the foundation, and now the Chris's or the Justin's or the Ryan and those guys are going to use those to take it to the next level, and they have, and they truly have. And they've, more importantly, from what I can see, they've empowered it. So what would be the hardest thing for somebody who started a business is to hand off the keys, right? I mean, I haven't been there, but I would believe that would be very tough.
Yep.
For them to hand it off and not do it too late, to give them the time to grow and then be there with them, supporting them. And that appears to what has happened so far. And if that continues, I think we'll see more and more family-owned business through the generations, because there's not necessarily a lot of new C27 licenses coming out of Sacramento right now with people coming at 19, 20, 21 years old, getting a license to do landscape construction, which we need to work on as an industry, I think.
So is that because young people don't see landscaping as a great business to go into, and they're choosing to go into, software and technology? Yeah.
That would be my guess. I would say yes. I think I've done a really good job. I've had ideas that distribution could do something better, manufacturing could do something better to promote the industry to young college kids, high school kids, show them, like me. I was at 20 years old, and I went to a house. It was, a 5-acre lot, it was a big home, all dirt, and went through it and saw it from dirt until the very end. And to me, that was just the most awesome thing in the world at 20 years old to see that. And I thought, if some of these kids see that, whether it's video or on site, you may see some more wanting to do that. And then I think some of them have the think that they, you can't make big money. You got to be Google, or you got to work for Apple to make big money. You can make plenty of money in landscape construction. Very, very successful companies out there that do very, very well for themselves personally and professionally.
Absolutely. Well, the newer companies and newer industries that are breaking, breaking barriers, they offer great gross margins, but eventually all industries get competitive and margins get tighter. But look, I know how good landscaping has been to me and my business, and I'm sure same to you, and many of these family businesses you're talking about, they've built out and carved out a really nice lifestyle for themselves. So let's talk about some of the guys, and let's not name names here, but sometimes fathers, founders, maybe it's mother and father, have trouble handing it off to the next generation. And I've heard a friend of mine call that the sticky baton syndrome. So the father is still kind of running the show and has trouble letting go. And I'm sure that you're out there, you're calling on these types of companies and finding that, like, do you speak to this to the next generation leader, or are you speaking to the older generation? And it gets a little sticky in between. What are some, maybe can you share some of your experience and maybe help some of these next generation leaders out to figure out how do they get the baton out of the dad's hand? What do they need to show them? What do they need to learn? Where do they need to go and get trained? Or, what are you seeing?
Yeah, well, from my observations, from the construction side, from the family owned to distribution, and I think you just even manufacturing, once again it's the handing over the keys. So how do you ask for the keys and not give him another set? I guess is the way I would look at it, right?
Right.
How do I take the keys and still let him get in as well? And I think that is what is the balance, is to be able to show that they're going to empower you. They're going to empower their son or daughter, whatever it may be, to be the president, to take over the company. But you need to give them that security to say, well, I still want you involved, and I want to have monthly meetings with you, dad or mom or whatever maybe. And that's important to me. We need to keep that going. I need you involved. I want to obviously build it and take the lead. I want the employees to recognize me as the president of the next generation moving forward, which I think is exciting for the younger generation that's working for a company to know that that's where it's going. Because if it's just staying with that generation, they don't know if they're just going to close shop. There's no plans. There's no big picture, big vision. That's extremely important, is the big vision. And one of the top three or four for the reasons for family businesses failing is the lack of empowering the next generation. And that's not knocking the generation. That's very hard. You get more stubborn than people and others. Or the truth of the matter is maybe that next generation hasn't done what they need to do to step it up. That happens too. And so that is a big part of the failures as well, as inner turmoil or commitment. The father committed 80 hours a week. Well, does the son want to do 80 hours a week? Does he need to? Probably not. Does the father expect him to do 80 hours a week? Probably. He doesn't do 80 hours a week, then we got issues. So there's a lot of dynamic stuff going on there, but I think in general, communication probably more important than anything at all is communication from the start to the end.
I agree. I think leadership development also is really important. They've got to teach them leadership skills, and it's not typically going to come from the father. So I'm wondering, is this the responsibility of the industry association, of the universities, of the horticulture schools and departments that are teaching just technical stuff? I mean, where do some of these soft skills and leadership and management and communication and conflict management and family dynamics, where does that belong? I know it belongs in my world, in my coaching, but where does it belong in the institutions that support the green industry, do you think?
I think everybody's unique. I don't rely on anybody for that. To me, it's like, go grab some books, mm-hmm. go get coaching, start learning it, be proactive, read how to be a leader, learn and observe people, spend time with mentors, parry people, learn how to publicly speak, join associations, get confidence. You fake it till you make it, right? So do that with your staff. Do what you got to do, and then have somebody from whether it's your spouse or your next generation or the generation before you, give you little observations or critiques and take it and learn from it, and say I'm all in. And if I fail as a leader, I'm not going to point my finger at my father or my mother or associations. I'm going to utilize those resources. But it's ultimately, if you're going to be a leader, you win as a leader, you lose as a leader.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And I mean, obviously, I do agree because that's the role that I think I've played. My book was going to be called What Got You Here Isn't Going to Get You There, because like your dad's way of growing the business, which probably didn't have much of a playbook, is, it's altogether different with now technology and, the level of business management and leadership sophistication among the youth today is so much different than when I was a young buck. They didn't have that much literature on those subjects. And there was one author, Peter Drucker, and he owned the entire bookshelf on leadership and management. And now, there's hundreds and thousands of books. So I agree. It's a distributed responsibility. And what I've seen though in California is if we want to continue to support manufacturing companies, we have to develop some kind of educational curriculum at the lower grades where they're seeing that, these are occupations that people should want to go into because you can make a good living and a good life. Otherwise, we're relying on, plumbers who are teaching, four generations down. Most plumbing companies are something and sons because these are businesses that are learned like from their fathers and their grandfathers. And there aren't that many trade technical schools for things like that. So, I'm sure you know and experience, the shortage of talent in this industry has been a long-standing issue. And it's even worse in other trades. So,
yeah, the professionalism. I mean, the landscapers. You ask most people, painters, electricians, and landscapers are the flakiest guys trades that you talk to homeowners, and unfortunately, that's true. I mean, you go ask homeowners, go on a block and ask 20 homeowners, yep, and you get those three in most cases, a lot of them, and that's unfortunate because it does label the ones that are not, under that umbrella, and so yeah, there is the ones out there that aren't helping the industry when it comes to that, stuff like that. And I think that, I think there needs to be people to go out there to do stuff like yourself or something, to go out there to say, listen, let me just gonna play it straight from the gut. Here it is. This is what the industry's looked at. This is why. And there's people in the crowd, and I can look in the crowd and go, I can tell you right now, there's 10 of you guys right here that don't return phone calls. And, I wouldn't be lying because they don't. And I used to take it personal, but I just know that that's just, they don't do it. They don't return phone calls to other people. And when times are really good and you're really busy, they don't return phone calls. And when there's a recession and things are bad, now all of a sudden they're desperate and they're going out there and they're wanting to do, they're service eagles all over. They're the best service guys ever. And so you got to be consistent with that kind of stuff.
100%. So, one of the concepts that I like to talk about is the role of disruptors. And disrupting businesses. And so if in a family business, you take some of the names that you mentioned, the Chris Angelos and Justin Whites of the world, I mean, they've had to be somewhat disruptive of the dynamics in their current business with the family to really take the business to the next level. And of course, they've had to leverage technology. They've had to do a better job with recruiting people. You're a guy who's been in this industry a long time. You've seen and are seeing a lot of disruptions, and I'd love to talk with you about some of what's going on, maybe just in terms of the product side. Weathermatic is an example of a company that came in and disrupted years ago, the irrigation and smart controllers. So Talk to us a little bit about Weathermatic, which is where you're currently at. Talk to us about Ewing, where you were at for years, and the role that these types of companies play in disrupting and, you know, or innovation, maybe is, you know, it's their role in driving innovation in this industry.
Well, just for credibility purposes, I'm not going to self-promote, you know, be honest with each other on Weathermatic or Ewing or whatever. I'll address in general distribution and manufacturers.
Great.
And whether, you know, whoever it may be. But yeah, things are changing when it comes to the industry, obviously with technology. You know, you got Wi-Fi controllers now, which, you know, who would have thought that, right? You have smart cellular, you know, based central control systems that you can run when you're in Italy and turn on things and be notified and check how much water you're using or saving and so on. So, I mean, it's out there. And when it goes into, when I say, I guess the word disruptive, it's the guys that are willing to take the plunge to get out of the normal. Nobody likes change, right? Change is a tough thing for anybody, but change is more painful when you don't do it. It feels painful to try something new, but you really have to move with the times. And you'd think that there's no way I can sell this $1,200 controller, but you don't know if you don't ask, because you just said that you're going to save them 38% in water or whatever it may be. You're not going to know unless you ask. And so the companies that are disruptive are the ones that are asking. They're the ones that are going and endorsing, you know, having all of their accounts, if you will, online. So every one of their maintenance accounts is going to be now online through, I would say, our SmartLink system. That's the only plug I'll do. But so you do that, and that's just, it saves money overall for the client, for you. It's more efficient. It saves water. You know, there's a bunch of that stuff. And it's not just that, it's even equipment, you know, from mowing equipment to mini skid steers to all kinds of different equipment stuff that you have to invest in for future growth. You see companies that have, you know, let's say 12 employees, and you have companies that have 30 employees, and they're going, okay, well, how are they getting that job or whatever it may be? Well, because they've invested for the last 5 years on equipment. And they can get that job done a lot quicker with the equipment than they can with five guys with shovels. And so there's different ways to look at how you go about your business on things like that. And so you may not have the money initially, but it's kind of like your return on investment. You got to kind of, maybe you have to pull it out of savings. You got to buy some of that equipment, whether it's for technology for your maintenance side or water management, and take the plunge and don't even bother the client because you know it's going to save you money on your routes. Or you just need to do it for your company and pass that on and learn how to articulate the value in that to your customers.
So one of my recent guests was a fourth generation family business that is running Holt of California with their Caterpillar distributor based out of Sacramento. And, you know, as I think about their business and I think about robots coming into this business, I mean, are you seeing the early signs of automation robots coming in that'll be mowing lawns? That'll be, I mean, we've certainly got it the artificial intelligence for water management. I don't know, maybe do you see more in that space, or are you seeing, I've heard of a few companies that are doing some research and development on, you know, like the iRobot, you know, that is going to be mowing the lawn. What are you seeing and hearing out there in the field?
Well, I know of a couple of companies, you know, firsthand that do have, automated mowers, you know, robot mowers, if you want to call them that. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's definitely something to look at. They're pretty impressive, to be honest with you. I've seen them and seen demos of them and so on. But you know, you go back into, okay, what do we do with the human beings? You know, I mean, I mean, it comes down to the bottom line. It's just like, okay, well, if we do that, so what do we do with the misplaced employees? So now we did that. We automated robot mowings for our company. Now we have to lose 47 employees, right? What do we do with 47 employees? So there's that conversation you can have, and then how do you know what do we do with that, or do we plan for it and we train those 47 to do this? and let's plan for it and not just land the bomb or plant the bomb, drop the bomb, if you will. I'm torn on that a little bit. I love technology. But I think that the mower stuff is, I think there's places for that, that it can be used.
Yeah.
I think big fields, ball fields,
golf courses, maybe
ball fields, golf courses, things like that, that, you know, you're not getting a guy behind, is that save money than a ride on mower, big mower or pushing it? Yeah. You know, at some point penciling out. Yeah. That's something to do. The everyday, average, large home and things like that. I think that needs to be left to the human.
I couldn't agree more. I don't see them going in and doing shrubs and plants and
the human element, if you will. So, but it's not going to go away. I mean, those are the facts. I mean, there's going to be a matter of time before there'll be a bobcat that you can program what to do, and the bobcat will probably do it.
Yeah.
Or you can do it remotely on your phone.
I went into many machine shops in my early days in consulting back in the 80s and 90s. And, everything was starting to move to computerized numerical control machines where you put the piece of metal in and you program it. It would cut out exactly the way it was done. And, I'd get some of these old machine shop business owners, and they were like, you can't find guys who really understand what they're doing. They just know how to run the computer, but they don't really know like what's involved and like how to actually make that the way we did it. And I think we will see some of that transition in the industry. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, we will. No doubt about it. We just need to get behind it because it's going to be there. It's not going to go away because you're going to have money behind it, investments behind it, and it will be there. But so either we endorse it, get behind it, but also learn how to use it and go from there.
Yeah. Now you're pretty familiar with the irrigation space, and that seems to be a particular area of the landscaping industry where it's very difficult to find companies that are good or specialize in it and find individuals that are good, knowledgeable irrigator tech folks. What's missing? Why is that? What can you tell us about that?
I believe that it's just consistency standards. It comes down to, the integrity of your business, your quality, your craftsmanship in different companies. Some companies will be very, very good at what they do and detailed and putting in things. And some companies simply will cut corners and not use the right stuff or simply just don't know. So some of it is a lack of awareness. Some of it's just simply cutting corners, wanting to make more money, not doing the right thing. And then some people just do the right thing and do it consistently. And I mean, big picture wise, those are the companies that continue to grow and get the reputation and of doing quality stuff. And there's out there, all the manufacturers, I think everybody out there on the manufacturing side has courses for training, has online stuff. Everybody does that to try to raise the industry standards. And I think it's whether I don't care what manufacturer you pick. It's a matter of just how it's put in and how it's followed up with and how it's, you can have a smart controller, but you can have a dumb system. So it doesn't matter how smart your controller is, but if your system that's installed in the ground is quote unquote dumb, if you will, and not done right, it doesn't matter what the smart controller does because the stuff down below is not working right. So it's extremely important to get everything down right. And there's, I think we do have some great stuff out there with IA certifications and CLCA water management programs that are utilized, but probably not utilized enough. And quite honestly, I don't think our industry does a good enough job marketing it, as in companies marketing that they have 7, certified landscape irrigation auditors on staff. They have, 4 water management certified guys. I think that you need to, you invest in your employees to get those certifications. You need to market the hell out of it. And I think that's important. I don't think enough companies do that.
Interesting. So what else is on the horizon for the green industry? What are things that you're excited about? What are things that you think need to happen? How can people like you and I and other people that are listening to this, give back more, make the industry more professional, better? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, part of how the industry, whether you like it or not, is state California regulations that have been coming and are coming. You know, in October, Title 20 came out, which is all pop-up sprinklers have to be pressure regulated stems, PRS 30 or 40. That came kind of right at the COVID time, if you will. So there's nobody policing that, enforcing that, if you will. Distribution can't sell anything that's not pressure regulated as a pop-up with manufacturers and so on. That's a big shakeup. And it'll probably even get worse when or if it does start getting policed or flagged on installations that are not that way. Technically, they did it right because if you can't get it from distribution, then you shouldn't be installing. You shouldn't be able to get those. Now, of course, there's always things of Amazon and things that you get from over the other state. You know, there's ways of getting them if you really want to get them. Let's not kid each other. But that is a wake-up call because you're talking about, I'm guessing, 80% of the contractors, unless it was specified on a blueprint, on their everyday installation of pop-ups, they're not putting in PRS sprays. That just wasn't happening. Now they go from spending, $1.09 for a 4-inch pop-up to $5. You're going from $3 to $8, from $7 to $15 or 12. It's a big, big jump when it comes to now you're doing that. They've had warning on that. It's just a matter of, you got to put that in the bids now. And your clients should know that. If not, you need to remind them of that you're having to absorb that these are the prices that have increased now. And I think this is going to continue to grow. But I'm also torn on the regulations because the regulations are good and fine and dandy when they're printed. But if nobody's following up on it, is anybody tracking that? You know, how much water is it saving? Is there any big numbers of what exactly did this thing do other than, honestly, raise the dollar amounts out the door for distribution and manufacturing, because now it's not $1.09, it's now a $4 transaction per sprinkler. So, we'll see.
Understood. And what is the intention behind the regulation? Like, is it to save water? Is that water runoff? Okay.
Yeah, save water. It's a waste of water.
But they don't have the data. You don't feel like there's the data to support.
I don't know. Well, it's too early. I mean, this was in place October.
Okay.
That this went into place. So and then the whole COVID thing. So, there's rebates of water districts and so on and different things that you get for doing that kind of stuff. Not so much that anymore because it's scary. You got rebates for doing that stuff prior to this, for putting in, pressure regulators, pop-ups and bubblers and different things like that. You got, rebates for, not so much anymore. You are getting rebates for the central control stuff, the smart water control, smart central stuff and things like that. But I would hope that at some point they're going to say, hey, since this PRS went, Santa Clara County Water District has estimated or measured or however they do it, I don't know. It's a savings of, 20 million gallons of water. Okay, cool. We'll see if that comes out or not. Or we're just going to go, okay, so what exactly did this thing do? Is it actually saving water or not?
Got it. All right, let me switch topics on you, talk about another issue, one that's been a longstanding conversation in the landscape industry, and that's unlicensed contractors. You talked about that early on in this recording. How big an issue is this still in California? I mean, is this something that people at the statewide level are upset about, concerned about, able to do anything about? What about that in terms of a trend in this industry? And by the way, these are mostly family businesses. I bet these unlicensed contractors. These are, I've seen the guy who used to mow my lawn, or on the weekends, and he would have his son and his nephew and his cousin, and they all pile into a truck. So,
I wouldn't say it's an issue. It's an issue to many. There's many that are much more vocal than others. Mm-hmm. They just can't stand it, and they're very vocal about it. Some that just kind of go, it is what it is. It's not taking any business from me. Right. There's that attitude as well. I also, there's people that have to make a living, and they're doing what they need to do. I think if they're taking away business from somebody's license and paying workman's comp and doing all the right things, then I don't agree with that. If they're going in there and doing that, if they're doing something that they're not taking away from anybody, if they're doing something that is not a huge liability of any sort, I do think that the unlicensed guy, if he did the right thing and did stuff, you know, technically I think it's over $500. You have to have a license in the state of California.
Right.
You know, that's kind of pretty small. I mean, you can have a really small front yard and backyard, and it's more than $500 a month, okay, to maintain it. So that one's a little tough. I think there could be a maintenance division somewhat where they just don't necessarily need a license, if you will. They just do mom and pop. Their maximum accounts are $1,000 a month, whatever it may be. But when you get into the construction side of it, absolutely you have to have a license. And so anybody that's doing construction that's not doing a license, then they need to be taught. I also need to think that we should, instead of going and calling the license police, I think we need to just go and say, hey, shake the guy's hand and go, hey, listen, I know you don't have a license. I don't really want to report you. What is it going to do to get you a license? And what can I do to be a mentor to help you do a license? You know, let's say pick an unlicensed guy for the month, or have some sort of program through CLCA where maybe the guy is just afraid to do it, but he just needs to have a conversation with somebody and he's willing to do all the work, and you're willing to help him out. And you're confident enough in your business that he's not a competitor, or if he is, you're better than him. It's kind of like when you're a manager or you're a boss, you're supposed to hire somebody that's as good as you, if not better, right? That's kind of the plan. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of mentality with unlicensed, I think, could be a win-win for the industry.
Good. Let's get back to family businesses as we start to wrap up here. And so you've worked for family businesses for a long time. Most of these, all of these companies that you said your whole career have basically been family businesses. And so in your experience, what's unique about these businesses from the other businesses that maybe you're up against, or maybe you've had opportunities to work for? Obviously you've chosen these companies for a reason, maybe because they were family businesses and that tipped the hat or hand for you. What's different about them, do you think?
Well, I mean, I know just because of the other side with the corporately owned and stuff, and there's definitely both sides, there's positives and negatives for both, for sure. Mm-hmm. I think the family businesses has, you know, a big part of family business, they focus on relationships. And I'm a big advocate of relationship sells and relationships and friendships. That's my life. And I do that. You know, you also kind of have, you know, the pride of a family owned. I'm a competitor, competitive, you know, kind of a sports mentality. And you have your father and your son. To me, it's kind of a prideful, competitive nature and feeling to it in many cases. I like that as well. You know, empathy, that's a little tougher at the corporate world, you know, quite honestly. I mean, you're owned by a large company and, you know, 17,000 employees and yeah, you maybe have local empathy I think that's important as well. And, I think the turnover rate in general, I think, is probably lower in most cases with family owned businesses. You know, I work for a company, that, you know, their average tenure on, quite honestly, it was 10 to 12 years, which in the industry is pretty unheard of. I think that's important. And so,
What about sustainability? Sustainability is a big buzzword in the green industry, right? Among other industries. And seems as though family businesses are probably more focused on sustainability, because just by the nature of wanting to keep it in the family, that they're trying to sustain that. So the mindset of how do we keep this in the family maybe also translates to an environmental sustainability mindset, or am I just making this up?
You know, I think that's kind of that, you know, I mean, just, you know, waving the sustainability flag is probably good for your company marketing wise.
Okay. So it's what they call greenwashing, I guess.
I would say it's probably that more so than actually sort of family ties to it.
Okay. But definitely a family business is focused on the sustainability of the business, as opposed to selling out to a larger company. They seem to hold out longer. There's no question the turnover, in my experience, is less. Their loyalty to their people. And I think that there's research that would support that they do a better job of creating culture and values, even if they're not necessarily articulated. they have pretty strong cultures for the most part. That's probably been your experience?
Absolutely. And I think the personal relationships, and there's the good and bad of that. So you have times where you have a family owned, and I've seen it, you can have a family member that gets promoted to a position that probably should have gone to somebody else that had more tenure, more experience. But so there's that dynamic that could be a bad thing too. So yep. you want to promote your son or your daughter or, you know, your nephew or whatever it may be. But the guy down here that's been with the company 12 years probably should have had that job. That happens. But that usually will probably correct itself in time. And it has, I think, in my experience. And so that does happen. And then coming back into, you know, I can tell you, I mean, if I was 28 years old, 33 years old, and was a president of a company, and I could make the decision, and I had a big VC coming to me and throw me a nice seven-digit figure, that's pretty hard to walk away from. But you got to look at the big picture, and you know, what are you going to do with that? And what are you going to do with your employees? So I know somebody firsthand that was a dear friend of mine. And the husband passed away and the wife is still around and recently sold to a very, very large company, the largest company in the world, let's put it that way. But part of her agreement was that her employees must stay and for a certain amount of time. And so that to me is important, and that shows you the family loyalty. And so I think that if that does happen, that would be something, obviously you would have to make sure that, this needs to happen or I'm just simply not going to sell. The employees and your family are more important than the money at that point, because that's a short-term fix, in my opinion.
Yep. Barry, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge. You are the fastest talking guy that I've ever had on. You have probably the most industry knowledge of anyone that's, you know, out in this business. And thank you, by the way, commitment and your devotion to, you know, promoting beautiful landscapes in California.
And you bet. No, I'm glad I was able to, you know, sometimes good when you're on the road by yourself, sometimes you talk in the mirror. So it's just nice not talking in the mirror for once. So,
all right, Barry, how do people get a hold of you? If you want,
you can get a hold of me at area code 559-290-0505 or my email at barry.elder@weathermatic.com.
That's fantastic. You are a man of great energy and enthusiasm. Thank you for the work that you do. So any final thoughts?
You. Yeah. No, I just keep doing what you're doing, Jonathan. I think just the more, you know, more resources for people to hear, whether I was babbling or whether people disagree with everything I said, who knows, but you have other resources out there, and I think it's a good thing.
Thank you very much. All right. So another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show in the can. If you like this show, please share it, listen, subscribe, and tell others about it. And thanks for listening. This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, the Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at the goldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session.
Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.